Alrighty guys, before today's episode, I just want to tell you something. We have got a live show at the Pavilion in Glasgow. Tickets are selling well, but there's still some available. Get them whilst you can. 31st of March, Easter Sunday.
Yeah, yes. Still some good seats available. They are going fast though, so if you want to get some cracking seats, do snap them up quickly.
Beautiful seats.
Good guests booked for that.
We've got some great, exciting guests that we've not announced just yet, but we'll do very shortly, if not already. So yeah, exciting times. It's going to be a brilliant show, so we look forward to seeing you there. As ever, you can also sign up to our Patreon for as little as £3 a month and get access to an extra episode every 2 weeks, plus bonus content from all our previous live shows. So if you're thinking about coming to the live show, maybe you'd want to sign up to the Patreon, see what they're like, see how much you laugh they are, and then next thing you know, you'll be sitting there seeing it live in person yourself.
Could you imagine? Yes.
Can you imagine? We love doing the live shows, don't we? They've always been really fun.
They're always
on the Patreon, like you say, from Glasgow, Edinburgh and London.
Funnest nights of the year for me.
And
for
me. The biggest show that we've done in the live shows previously is about 300 people, which was brilliant at the Glee.
It was amazing, yeah, it was great.
There's going to be, we're talking over 1,000 laughers, can't be wrong, the Pavilion. It's going to be incredible, so if you don't want to miss out on that, so...
It's a historic venue as well.
Historic event, I thought you were going to say.
And it will be a historic event as well, you know.
We've got the cherry picker there, don't
one
you
day they'll be a plaque.
That's
a
where
plaque
all the profits
up.
Are going, to the cherry picker.
I'm getting, yeah, just for me coming on to... And the rights to Michael Jackson's Earth Song are the two things that are taking up much of our budget.
On the Patreon, you also get a bonus episode once every 2 weeks. They're always really fun. We're about to record one now. I'm excited about it. You can send us questions and we'll answer them. And we will be current patrons.
We will be including more stuff, including extra features or extra bits from the public episodes, etc., very soon too. So do check
all
that
level that shit up. So get in on the ground floor while you can.
Well, you can. We're over 500 patrons strong, by the way. Now,
can't be
wrong, thank you guys.
Hey.
And it's all the bits that are too below for the public apps that will go there. Don't
Steve always makes promises like, I don't know what you think.
We're getting dick out over there, don't you worry.
We're like Barry Keoghan, whatever his name is, and so on. We're getting our fucking cocks out.
Improvised scene.
This is true. Much like this.
If you can believe it, this is all improvised.
This is basically salt bun. But listen, guys, so hopefully sign up to Patreon. Hopefully see you at the Pavilion. And aside from that, enjoy today's episode.
Enjoy.
I'm coming from Mark's family and taking the studio.
Welcome to the Some Laugh Podcast.
It could be like, oh, that was some laugh, or there was just some laugh.
Well, no promising all laugh.
No, there's going to be some.
It's some laugh.
Special.
Oh, thank you, man. I need the views, morning. Man. No, I need any view is a good view for me, man.
It was great, man.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you for checking it out.
It
spending an hour.
Yeah, well, he didn't do the last 10 minutes, as he's just told me.
By the way, is the theme of this. Yeah, the whole the serious bit, innit?
Oh, every time we get a guest on, I always try and do some sort of research.
Oh,
and
that's
then,
good, man. I appreciate that.
But then I always... So we had, like, Fern Brady on talking about our book, and I only got halfway through it. And it's a good book.
Most
just...
interviewers don't tell the guest, but we keep doing
it. Yeah, because... we fucked up.
It's because I just leave it last minute, so I'm doing it the morning of, and I'm like, I can't read a book in a fucking morning.
Yeah, you've got to spend time with a book. You've got to spend time.
So with the special, I watched, I think I got to 52 minutes and I ran out of time. I had to come here.
Oh,
so
okay.
So I don't know how it ends.
Oh, I could either tell you or you could watch
I'm
it.
Watch, I'm going okay. to watch it. Okay. Yeah. Is there a big twist?
No, there's not really a big. There's not really a big thing. It's similar themes. I guess by 52 minutes, you kind of know where I'm going with the... Did you find out what happened with the case?
That's the bit that I'm on.
Okay. Right.
Do you want? Can we explain that to the listeners, or does that ruin the special? Do we want to do that? Or?
No. I guess by the fact that I'm out and I'm free to tell the story should give an indication that nothing, nothing untoward came to it. But
what kind of case? A court case?
It was a coroner's court case, so right. not a criminal court, coroner's court. But that's something that I also talk about in the show. That initially I thought it was criminal.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, what the fuck, man?
So that's the bit that I'm on, like you're talking to your mum about.
Yeah. She got me fucked up, man. She scared the hell out of me. I thought I was going to prison, man. I thought, bro, like that's it. I'm done for.
Because there is, like, in the show you're talking about, different examples of, was it Michael Jackson's doctor?
He did 4 years, I think Comrade something, Comrade Murray, there we go. Michael Jackson's doctor, 09, obviously when he passed. So the problem was, he was getting $90,000 a month to be this guy's doctor, one patient. $90,000, and he fucked it up. He's crazy. That's the easiest gig I know. Just keep one person alive. $90,000 a month.
To be fair, but if that person is Michael Jackson, fucking hell, that's a shift, to be fair. Like.
Hey, yeah. He was giving him the wrong drugs, man. He was giving him the wrong drugs. You don't give nobody propofol. Have you heard of propofol before?
Aye.
It's the... It's Nicki Minaj sings about it. Propofol, you know they hope I fall. It basically, it's an anesthetic. It's when puts you to sleep. Uh-huh. It's a general anesthetic. It puts you... So when you can have your operation. He was given this so he could sleep because he had Michael Jackson had insomnia. He was giving him little doses so he could sleep the night. That's crazy. That is off license. So, you know,
yeah.
I think probably just gave him too much and then...
So he can't.
So Michael Jackson's still sleeping.
Yeah, fucking hell.
He's still sleeping.
It worked in a way.
Yeah. So he was. Maybe it's just a long sleep.
Man, that's the easy. Hey, tell you that he could have come up from the grave, Michael. Who knows? The dose had wear off.
Be like the thriller video.
Poetic. Absolutely poetic. So, yeah, that's. So he went to prison because they're like, look, you killed this man. You gave him.
Are you, as a doctor, are you on his side?
Or should we? Can we explain that for the listeners? Actually,
are we started? Oh yeah, my man! Yeah, we're in. Okay, all right, let's go. So for the listeners, you can't, as a doctor, you shouldn't be killing anyone.
No.
Obviously, death unfortunately happens.
Is that what they tell you day one in medical school?
You should, thou shalt not kill. It's like one of our commandments. That's the first thing that's on the screen. Thou shalt not murder. So you shouldn't have. Obviously, we know with the field. People that come to you unwell, and some people will pass away. It's the cycle of life. You see people being born, you deliver babies, and you see people on the end of their life. Hopefully it's geriatric when they're old and a bit crumbly and they've reached the end of their life. So people will die.
Yeah.
You understand that and you come to terms with that. But of course, if it's an unexpected death or where there's any fear of malpractice, then obviously it goes to the courts to find out if there's any negligence involved or whatnot. And that's what happened in Michael Jackson's case. This guy was given drugs he shouldn't have been given off license. Mm. So a drug to put you to sleep for an operation is not a drug you should take just because you want to sleep the night.
Mm.
And that was the big problem with Comrade Murray. And that's what I think they convicted him of manslaughter.
Right.
So I wouldn't say I was on his side because he was doing a madness. He shouldn't have been doing what he was doing.
Yeah.
But it just goes to demonstrate that when it comes to medical care, particularly someone who's high profile, if something goes awry, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on you. You could go to prison. Uh-huh. So I just used that case in the show, No Scrubs, just because it was a high profile case that people would be maybe aware of, or obviously everyone knows who Michael Jackson is. So you say his name, it just piques your interest. Because there's so many cases I could have referred to during the show, but if it's not someone you've heard of or don't give a damn about, it's hard to get someone interested. You guys are standard. You know, you pick something which is interesting or will pique your interest. So I used that case, but then I also took a bit more about another case which I felt the guy was hard done by.
Right. Yeah.
And that was a guy, he was a general surgeon working privately, I think down in London somewhere, or down definitely south of here. And he had referred a patient with... I believe it was a bowel perforation. Yeah, bowel perforation. So that's basically got a hole in the bowel and you got your poo coming into your abdomen. So you need to sort that out straight away. That's an emergency. You need to operate that. You need to plug that hole. Stop the shit floating around. He knew that, but then there was an issue with the delay to actually operate on the person. I think there was concern about having an anaesthetist, someone to put the person to sleep and the staff to do it.
Uh-huh.
But because of the delay, the patient obviously unfortunately passed away. By the time they got to him, I think during operation or just after, passed away. And he was the only one that got charged with manslaughter. So they didn't just say, oh, you know, there was problems in the system that caused the person to pass away. They were like, no, you through your actions killed this man. I was like, what the? So he spent 15 months in prison, Belmarsh Prison, down in London. That's a top security prison.
Yeah.
That's where the murderers are, where the rapists are. And in the show, I joke, that's probably where Tim Westwood should be. So it's a serious place. And they had this doctor who was trying to save a life, spending 15 months behind bars.
Yeah.
So that was crazy. So these were the things that were, in my mind, as I'm getting this letter through saying I got to go to court because I was involved in care of someone who unfortunately passed away. So it was more of a case of, what the fuck? What's going on, man?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm 6 months into this career. You're telling me I could go to prison?
So does that happen every time a patient in care passes away? You get...
No. So, no, that's the thing. Like, this is going to sound crazy. I've looked after people who have passed away. That doesn't sound right to say, but as I was saying earlier, the cycle of life and stuff. And if someone comes to the natural end of their cycle, you fill in the paperwork and whatnot. And normally... Every death gets reported to the coroner. No, that's a lie. If there's a suspicion around the death, then it gets reported to the coroner, or there was something untoward. Or, for example, if you have a medical procedure in the hospital and someone passes away the next day, then that gets reported to the coroner because something you may have done may have caused the person to pass away. So it's not routine that the coroner gets involved. But then if they do get involved and they feel there's any ill behaviour or something negligent, then that's when it gets referred to the coroner's court and they may call you in and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that when I got that, I was like, what? I didn't expect it.
And do you know anyone who's ever had that before or anything like that?
Nothing. Yeah. I'm like a baby doctor. It's like, it's almost like I made the joke that like I'm Bart Simpson and I'm the baby, but the consultant, Homer, they didn't want Homer, they wanted Bart. Why are you going for little Bart? Like, why are you going for the small guy? But fortunately, my consultant at the time did come to the court case and gave evidence, and definitely with his support and the evidence, they found that there was no negligent behavior in the case I was involved in. Uh-huh. So nothing happened to it. Just found like elderly guy died of natural causes, and that was it. So I was like, phew. But obviously the build up to that, it's tense, man. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like you're thinking your career could be done, dusted, thrown out.
Go to jail.
What are you here for? Murder. I stabbed this guy 20 times. What are you here? I'm a rapist. I'm a crazy. I should be behind. What are you here for? Trying to save a life.
Yeah.
How is it comparable?
Exactly.
Yeah. Why did they think there was any sort of question over that?
So what happened with this, the patient I was involved in, he was discharged to a care home. And unfortunately, that same evening he was discharged, passed away. Oh. So obviously, understandably, it's like, well, you were just in hospital. Why would they let you go if you weren't well? So that's what spiraled it. And I think the family involved went to the police and stuff like that. So I'm getting like coroner's police letters. What? Police want me for what? So you're thinking, I'm just doing my job. What do you want me for?
Yeah.
But it's protocol. So I understood it, but it did shake me up a bit, you know what I mean? Like, you don't, you think you're there in science to sort of help people, then something like left comes your way. You think, what the hell?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I understand if there's negligence, like you say, or someone like Harold Shipman or whatever.
Yeah, then a madman. Because they hear all this scrutiny's happening, man. Fucking Harold, man. Mad guy. Putting a lot of us under pressure.
But like for the NHS, it's a free service. Something might go wrong. Like, I don't think that person can sue. Or do you know
in
what
America,
I mean?
It seems like they sue them all the time.
It's more litigious in the States, definitely. But people do sue, particularly, like, we have to get what we call medical indemnity. So if you work for the NHS, there's indemnity if you work. Also, like, you work for service, something goes wrong, you're protected by that. But you're always advised to get your own professional one, just in case. So particularly if you work in obstetrics, i.e. you're helping deliver babies, because obviously there's complications that happens with the deliveries. If a baby's born with a deformity that happened during the birth, trust and believe that mother's got a suit.
Yeah.
And it could be to the tune of 6 or 7 figures.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, seriously. So
even if it's like just there's nothing that's happened to that light.
I think the light just went off. If there's a problem, if it's believed that there was negligence on the part of the medical staff that's led to this deformity, then there's gonna be a payout.
Right.
There's gonna be money that's gonna be paid.
I'll be rubbing my 4 fingers together, going, yes, like give me the money.
Hey, so you want a deformed child? Just hey, you're a crazy guy, Stephen. Man. Hey, comedy can't be that bad.
Well, I'm just saying, if you miss a finger, who's gonna miss a finger?
Yeah. Get some material out of a fucking shirt, Mitchell.
I'll write that.
I read that book called Black Box Thinking by Matthew Syed, and he was talking about how like they were trying to bring in more sort of like admission of mistakes and stuff in NHS, and trying, like, because there was a lot of things would go wrong and they weren't learning from mistakes, because basically there was a sort of culture of like trying not get the blame for it or kind of covering up mistakes, because obviously you're always at risk for these
100%.
Things.
Yeah. 100%. There should be more sort of frankness to say, you know what, that was a mistake. We made a mistake, and look at reasons why the mistake happened, so it doesn't happen again.
Aye.
There should be like, there was this case, separate case, a doctor called Dr. Hawa Garba. She was a pediatric registrar who just come back from, I think, maternity leave. And she was on a shift where her boss wasn't on site. So it was basically an unsafe shift. There was not enough staff to cover the patients that were there. And unfortunately, there was a child whose sepsis was sort of missed or not acted upon in time, I hope I'm saying this correctly. And unfortunately, the child passed away. And again, they're looking at causes for the death and whatnot. And they found her sort of negligent, and she either got charged and then got convicted, but then it got squashed later on or something along those lines. But she wrote in her, we have, doctor, you have to do these reflections. And she wrote in her personal reflection about the case. And they used the evidence, they used what she wrote in her personal reflection as evidence against her.
Wow.
As in like admitting guilt, or I can't remember what she exactly said. Right. But when she's reflected, and as this Matthew Sayre guy is saying, you know, look, reflect and think about how we could do better and stuff like that. Because you can acknowledge the mistake has happened, acknowledge what you could have done to prevent that mistake, but it doesn't hold you totally culpable.
Yeah.
No.
But now it's becoming a culture where people may not want to write these reflections to be honest, because you may use this against me.
Yeah.
So don't tell me to reflect and think about what you could do better and write it down and da 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 da. If you're going to use that in a court against me, that's crazy. No one's going to be honest then.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. In healthcare, I think it's different to the police. When there's a fuckery in the police force, the blue wall comes up. No one's saying nothing. They're keeping it stumped. They don't say nothing. That's how these cases seldom get solved, because no one's snitching and no one's telling the truth.
Yeah.
And I always find it interesting comparing healthcare to policing, because policing, they just, they will even start lying on the victim. This person, you know, they were threatening me. They had a weapon. They were going to withdraw the weapon. They and you see CCTV. Doesn't demonstrate anything. So I'm not comparing us to the police, but I'm just saying that it's interesting when backs are to the wall, how different forces react. So
that's true. Are you on sabbatical just now? Is that
on a sabbatical. So I wanted to see whether these jokes can really pay the bills, man. So I'm trying to see. I'm a year to my son was born in October 2022, and since then I've been a house husband.
Right, okay.
So I'd be the one to look after him during the day, then in the evening go told these jokes, and then me and my wife do a little baby swap. I hand the baby over and then she looks after him in the evening whilst I go told these jokes. So that's what I've been on. So I want to give myself a couple of years just to see whether there's anything in comedy for me, whether it's a hobby or whether there's a career. And I'm trying to use these 1 or 2 years to really find out.
Yeah.
And so you see that happened 6 months in with the court case and stuff like that. So by the time that was all resolved, how far were you in? Were you still practicing while that was ongoing?
Yeah, for sure. So it wasn't like I was on like gardening leave or something like that. It's not like, hey, this guy's suspended. What are you doing in hospital? Get the fuck out of here. No, it wasn't like that. It was just, you're still working and stuff. There's nothing on my record or anything like that. It was just more, as I thought it was like you're being charged criminally, but what it actually technically was you're being summoned to coroner's court to give evidence of that could help determine why the reasons why the person passed away, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I'm being summoned as a medical witness rather than defendant plaintiff.
Mm-hmm.
So I assumed when I got let through, I'm on the dock here, man. I could, you know, go away. But then initially it was just, you know, you're giving evidence. But what's happened in the past, especially with the general surgery guy I referred to earlier, is that sometimes you could be in coroner's court, give your evidence to the medical witness, and they'll be like, hey, by the way, hey, man, you look like you fucked up, man.
Yeah.
Hey, we're going to charge you with manslaughter. So sometimes that you could be there telling your story, but hey, it looks like you fucked. Hey, we think you fucked up. Now you're the defendant. Now you're in court trying to defend yourself. So sometimes that's what also was in my mind. I could be here, this will happen. They could be, hey, by the way, man, you look, hey, we think you fucked up.
Aye.
Now you're a defendant. Now, you know, the walls everyone's back to the wall, and the walls go up and stuff like that. So that's what was also fit. I was thinking, I said, shit, this could go.
Yeah.
They could take this left. And your life is in their hands, so to speak. It's funny, as a doctor, people's lives are in your hands, but this we give the power away in that scenario because it's very hard. I know I'm demonstrating you can pivot, but once in a vocational job like medicine, it's hard to. If someone takes away your license, what the fuck are you going
to
do?
You need to dedicate so much to it. It's time, like these footballers that get injured or something.
Yeah.
And then what the fuck do they do? Because they've put everything into that.
100%. You're so invested in it. And there are transferable skills, but it's hard to know what those are, especially if that's all you know. You're like, it's almost like comedy. If you're like 100%, I'm doing comedy. I'm just doing open mics. I'm doing semi-pro. I'm doing pro gigs. And then for whatever reason, you're like, you can't do comedy. Some people be lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you pivot? There are things you can pivot to, but what do you do? And that's definitely something that I was conscious of, especially 5 years studying. After 6 months, someone could be like, nah, you don't do this anymore.
Yeah. Mm. So were you doing comedy while that happened? How far into your medical training and stuff did you start?
So I started, funny enough, almost like at the conclusion of the case, this case. So what had happened, we have something called, they're called SWORTS rounds in healthcare. It's basically once a month, staff meet up and they talk about difficult cases they've been involved in or a difficult situation pertaining to work. And I was telling my colleagues about this case. And it's not a funny situation, but I guess my retelling of it was funny. I guess I was talking about how my mum was overreacting and stuff like that. And they were laughing. I was thinking, I'm being deadly serious here, but you're finding my retelling of the story quite comical. I was thinking, obviously, to take a difficult subject and make it funny, there must be something in that.
Yeah.
And people would tell me, oh, Mike, you got banter, your jokes, you're quite witty. So I thought, let's find out, man. So I signed myself up for an open mic in Greenwich, South London, but it's called, I didn't know the Gong Show.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea, man. It was just a local club to me. I just went on, it's called The Blackout at Up the Creek.
Of course.
I invited people down. So it's only when the MC was there, be like, oh, yeah, by the way, you got 5 minutes, but all these members have cards and they could put the cards up and black. I was like, what the fuck? But because I invited people, I was like, you know, I got to hold it.
Yeah.
And I've watched the video back a few times. I cringe, man. I don't take the mic out the stand. I got my hands in my pocket. And literally, I lasted 3.5 minutes.
Oh, fuck. Which and you've brought an audience with you as well?
I brought people with me. Fuck. So that's for, I was like, that is pretty good. And for my first time doing stand-up. I don't know if these thoughts of mine are funny, because all they are thoughts at this point.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're jokes. I'm just saying what I think is funny. So,
but did your friends that you brought, did they know that it was a Gong Show now?
No, they didn't. I was like, I'm doing comedy. I'm just like, hey, man, do you know this comedy thing I've been talking about? I'm going to try it, man. Come to the club.
Yeah,
we'll just get some drinks in after. Just come see me do my thing. And it's only when the MC obviously took the axe around the corner and said, by the way, just had to show. I was like, what the fuck is this? But I couldn't back out. Like, the thing, if they didn't come, maybe I would have low-key just slid out. Yeah. I don't know. I really don't know.
But it must have been funny for them if they didn't know it was a Gong Show, and then you obviously didn't to begin with.
Yeah.
And then they start like fucking seeing people trying to get you off stage. I'm like, what's going on?
Thank God they didn't have a card. I know they would have put that shit straight up. Hey, man, I don't know if I would have lost 3.5 minutes, maybe 30 seconds, maybe. I don't know. But fortunately, I caught the bug after that gig, man. That, as you guys probably know, when you make a room just erupt with laughter, it just does sink.
Yeah.
It did sink to me, man. And I'm chasing that same laugh to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, nearly 7 years on, I'm chasing that feeling of the whole room just going crazy off something you said. I'm like, I've made this up in my bedroom. You guys are going nuts.
Yeah.
What? Yeah, you just feel, you feel like Superman.
Yeah. It's feel amazing. Like Superman. That was 2017?
Yeah. That was like June 2017 I did that. And then I had like this exam I was providing for. So I didn't do any comedy for 3 months. Then I restarted properly September 2017 and just been going since.
Yeah.
Just been going that's taking me here, sitting with you guys right here,
this
man.
Is it. How did you find, because so you would have been 3 years in when lockdown hit
Yeah, for sure.
How did you find that? Like, just kind of starting out in your career as a
terrible
comedian?
Timing, man. Like, obviously, comedy is all about timing. That was, obviously, it was very sad lockdown. Loads of people lost their lives, but personally, it was terrible.
Can he fucking rap you with all of the ADFs as well? Jesus Christ. Fucking hundreds of letters through the door. Everything. Oh, for fuck's sake.
The time, it was crazy, but because just before February 2020, I'd won Comedia. It was Club Down, but they got Branch and Bath, but the Brighton, they had the new comedy award, it was the inaugural year, and I was fortunate enough to win it.
Oh, well.
So I won that, and off the back of that, signed with Steven's agent's Blue Book. So I'm signing, obviously talking. I'm like, I just won an award, got a decent write up on Chortle. I'm signing with an agency, and then Boris Johnson comes on the TV standing by a lectern telling us we're shutting down everything. I'm like, oh man. But obviously in the medical world, I could tell that we're moving there anyway because we're seeing patients come in and stuff. So it wasn't a major surprise, but comedically, I was like, oh shit. This, I didn't, obviously none of us knew what was going to happen.
No.
And it was funny because even earlier as that, I was thinking, man, like if comedy's going in this world, then This could be a career for me. And I'm thinking, oh shit, what how do I make it a career? Yeah. I'm having all these thoughts, and then with the pandemic, comedy shuts down completely and medicine ramps all the fuck up. So I was like, it'll put everything into perspective. Whilst I'm enjoying telling these jokes, if push comes to shove, there's definitely something which is essential and something which is 100%. The whole time key worker came out and stuff like that. It's like key worker.
Yeah.
And don't give a fuck if you told these jokes. No one cared, man. We're trying to work out on Zoom and all that type of stuff. It's like, this is optional.
Yeah.
That's how the government, entertainment was optional. The last thing to open up wasn't it? Have all the things that.
Yeah.
Well, they were telling everybody to retrain if they worked in the arts, whereas you were a medic, try to retrain as a comedian.
Yeah. Hey, man, I got it fucked up, man. I'm like, give me a mic and stage, man. Get me off these wards. But it put everything into perspective. It definitely, like, reminded me. Not that I forgot, but definitely reminded me that, oh, man, like, what you do is actually very important.
Yeah.
And you make a difference to people and stuff like that, which I enjoy, and I don't take it for granted, but I guess it's weird, like the feeling you get, the euphoria you get from telling a good joke is probably similar to the euphoria you get when you've been involved in someone's care. Like I was doing a bit of surgery. So if I was the one that sort of helped fix someone's hip and I've seen them come into hospital not being able to walk, and I've the one that's seen them in A&E, got their paperwork ready, then I've done the operation and then now I see them on their way out and they're walking.
Yeah.
That feels amazing. You know what I'm saying? That's comparable with, you know, making a whole room laugh, the euphoria you get from it. But I guess comedy is even more instant. It's a drug, man. That dopamine hit. Woo! You get joke. Hey man, I understand why people are drug addicts. Yeah. I don't condone it, but I understand. If it's the same dopamine hit I get from the stage, I get why you go and go get it that way. I don't condone it, obviously, but I understand the feeling of being addicted to that euphoria.
Yeah.
And when you're stitching someone up in a surgeon's table, they're not giving you a round of applause straight away, are they?
Hey, man, they wait, they have a look at it, enjoy how it's looking, then they decide. Not even a round of applause, hey, thanks, doc, I appreciate that. And you're like, all right, man, thank you, man, but it's not a, you're amazing.
You
have to have a steady hand for both as well, because even on stage, if you're shaking, like, this guy's shit. But
100%,
same as being a surgeon.
My goodness, yeah, you can't stitch anyone up in your hands like this, man, and you're sweating. They're gonna be like, hey, you ain't done this before.
What do you get more nervous before a gig or before a surgery?
Oh, good question. I think with a surgery, obviously, I'm where I was still training, so I'm always got someone above me who's got to be there. Even if I may be leading it, an operation, I've always got someone who actually been here, done it before. When it stands,
so you're just doing 10 minutes in the middle, like, it's like Sack, he's new to the surgery game, but I'm coming.
Hey, I did an open spot in the surgery. It's funny because
I don't want to go on the new act night when I'm in for fucking
trouble. Yeah, going to Tuesday, you're fucked.
Yeah, the weekend though.
But no, it's all funny. When you're a newer, so, or you're training, I should say, they get you to close the wound. So that's the, like, right. The, if you want to call it the open spot bit and stuff like that. And when you're a bit more advanced and they allow you to open, you literally are the one opening the skin. So that's like the opening spot. And then the closer actually does the main pit of the operation, yeah, right. The hard part. It was orthopedic, so it was like putting the bones together, putting the metal working and stuff. So that's like the close. That's wow. Like the headline of coming and doing the business, and then they'll let the opener and they'll let the open spot come and close the wound. And
wow.
Essentially, so when you get to the point where you can do all three and you can MC as well, you do the whole operation start to finish by yourself.
Then your socials taking on the road.
Hey man, yeah, you're going to different hospital all day and doing the operation. Yeah, you're doing a solo tour, man. So yeah, so. Basically, the next stage of my training would have been 6 years of like hard training. And I definitely wouldn't be able to do comedy at the same intensity I'm doing it now.
Right.
So before committing to such, that's why I was like, let me take a sabbatical and find out, you know, where these jokes can really sort of take me. Because I will struggle to do both at the same level.
Yeah.
Just because you can't be like, oh, I'm a comic and you're trying to do spots around the country or whatever it is. And then you're like, no, then you need, then you've got to start operating. You can't just sort of... Both aren't just things you could just do. You kind of need to, if you want to make a success of either, you got to give it single majority of your time, 100%.
Do you get squeamish and stuff about blood and that? Are you used to?
Nah, you see so many things that, yeah. Hey, like the most squeamish I probably got was when we had to go to, the morgue. We had to spend, part of our training was that you had to spend like a morning and an afternoon in the morgue seeing the pathologist.
Fuck.
Go like basically... cut these bodies up. That's the most straightforward way, because if they want to determine the cause of death or whatever, they weigh the organs, and so you have to take the organs out of the bodies and put them on these weighing scales. And right. And seeing the way these guys, because they have the pathologists there, but they have these technicians that help them, and the technicians, I'm like, I think we should check their bedrooms every 6 months. Just because you must lose your mind if you're chopping up. Your job is to chop up dead bodies. That's your role. You just go in and they are methodical with it. They do this thing where they do ear to ear, so they start at the back of the ear, cut, 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 cut. And then they unflap.
Ugh.
And then they get a saw into the cranium. They get access to the brain. They do this mad thing with the tongue where they, obviously your tongue's connected to your throat, so they just almost they cut. It's like they cut open ear, then they pull the tongue through. Hey, they do some mad stuff. And I'm there like, oh.
And did someone ever come and go, no one's asking you to do this?
What kind of paranormal activity is this? Like, this is crazy.
Why are you like swinging about the tongue like a lasso?
They're just so business with it. That's what it's like. Nah, we need to like do some checks on your mental status. Like, are you sure? Hey, So I was like, that's the most I've been like, that is fucked.
Are they all like weird people who work in that as well? Because you must be pretty fucked.
Of course. Well, I think you have to be. That's what I'm saying. Like, they don't talk as well. It's kind of like, dum, 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 dum. I'm like, it freaked me out. That pathology and definitely the morgue was definitely the place I was like, yeah, this is freaky. I don't like that.
You wouldn't want to go for a pint with one of those cunts.
No.
It's a good line to have though for stand up if you're ever having a bad gig. And there's like Morgan here, and I should know, by the way. Yeah. But because that's the thing, because obviously everybody always says with stand up, people come up to you all the time and go, I don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
I genuinely feel like with medical stuff, and I've got a few mates that are doctors or nurses or whatever, and I couldn't do it, and I'm because I'm quite squeamish when it comes to health and all that stuff, and like you're saying about
I'm quite hypochondriac.
Oh, okay, you always think something's wrong with you.
Yeah.
So can you have a look at this? No,
you wouldn't be the first.
I genuinely couldn't do it, and like you were saying about like you need to kind of come to terms with death and stuff like that, but I almost like sort of feel like ignorance is bliss sometimes. I'm like, I just don't even want to know. Because is that thing in there that like people, if you're studying a particular disease or something like that, you kind of convince yourself you might have it and all that
It's easy to do, especially if you're learning something new for the first time. Like, do I have that? Especially a lot of mental health stuff, like, do I have that? Do I have that? Okay. Do I like blocks? Do I like blocks? You're there, mark yourself. Am I OCD? You're definitely always checking where you have something. Mm-hmm. But definitely, it's more exposure. The more times you're exposed to something, the desensitized you get.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So blood and stuff, you see it so many times and you're sort of get used to it. It's almost, but we did have a few people, like first year medical school, we have to do, in Nottingham where I went, you have to do something called full body dissection. So people who have passed away have dedicate their bodies to anatomy, and essentially you dissect the body, get used to learning the different organs and whatnot. And a few people would come and throw up because they're like,
yeah,
this is a dead body. Yeah. So then, I mean, those people are now doctors, so you do get through it, but there is, everyone has their sort of level that they get grounded down to a level where they can tolerate it.
What's the hardest part for you? Because like for me, like stuff, like, just like the hours and stuff, sometimes you expect to do that, it always seems like it would be a lot. And like, but other than the morgue stuff, like see the actual kind of day to day the job, because obviously you've got Adam Kay wrote that book.
Yeah,
and stuff
absolutely,
like that.
Yeah. Absolutely,
and
man.
What kind of stuff, like for people? Because like for us, like I can't even imagine what must go into. Like being a junior doctor or being a doctor.
Yeah, yeah, man. I'll definitely say the bureaucracy. Like, you spend so little time, I feel, with actual patients helping them.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it is the admin and paperwork around sort of helping them. So, for example, let's say I'm on call. I'm the orthopedic doctor on call. So that basically means that people come to A&E, let's say they've got a really bad broken wrist or they've broken their ankle, let's say ankle. You go to A&E may see you, then they may call me if they think you need an operation. I need to go see you. So I'm the person that will go down and see you. I would obviously, hopefully A&E have done the x-rays and stuff, and I'll go chat to you about what happened and your story and your history and stuff like that. I need to make sure that you're in a cast, and I've checked the x-ray in the cast to make sure it's in the right sort of position. If I feel you need an operation, I may need to get a CT scan. And all of these little things I'm saying, I need to either do myself or organize that for you. So even just getting a CT scan. I mean, I need to go on whatever computer system, book CT scan. More time, I'll need to call the radiologists, so the doctors that deal with scans, essentially. Yeah. Be like, hi, I want to do this scan. The request should be there, and then have a debate of why, if they're happy to vet the scan, so I approve it. Mm-hmm. Then I need to call the radiographer, who are the people that actually physically do the scan, and be like, hi, the radiologist has agreed to do the scan. Are you happy to do it? When can I send the patient to have the scan? So just getting a scan involves all those sort of steps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I understand why you need your checks and balances, but then if you're on call, that people, any other emergency that comes in, I need to be ready for.
Mm.
So you're trying to get someone sort of sorted, and you want to hopefully do it. If you're efficient, hopefully they just come to the hospital one time with a broken ankle. You get all, like, if you need to do blood tests, you do all this stuff now. So the next time they come in, they just have their operation. It's not like, oh, it's not multiple trips to the hospital before your operation.
Yeah. Right,
so if you're trying to be efficient that way, but there's so many hoops you need to jump through to make that happen. And that's the stuff that is annoying. It's just like, it's just too bureaucratic. There's too much admin rather than just helping the patient. Because that patient just needs an operation. But to get to the point where they're on the table and you're operating on them, so much dancing you need to do.
Is that because, like you were saying before, about if someone fucks up, you need to know exactly where it happened and who to blame, essentially? Is it for that purpose?
Well, it's just more like, otherwise, because CT scans, they're the risk of radiation. Anytime you put a patient for a scan, there's risk of radiation. And so the radiologist and their team need to make sure that they follow the scans appropriate. So, but then you can't just be like, Mark, I think you need the scan. All right, go. They're going to be like, okay, who ordered the scan? What's the indication? Why have they ordered it? Should it be done out of hours? It's Saturday night. Can they not wait for Monday? Because out of hours, there's less staff around and stuff like that. So you have to almost justify why you're doing all these things, so just to get the scan.
Mm-hmm.
But where your boss, your consultant, will be like, well, I need the scan to plan the operation. So you're trying to please too many people, but you end up sometimes not pleasing anyone because you can't get your stuff done.
It sounds like, as well, like it's just that, you know, if there was more people you could hand that off to do that sort of stuff.
And that would be brilliant.
Obviously, we all know that NHS, it's like, you know, it's been stretched at the moment and stuff like that. And so do you, like, see if you're working on it and stuff, would you say, like, the problem is, like, needs more funding and maybe more staff and more people to just kind of help out with that type of thing rather than everything being so stretched and you having to, like, spin all these plates?
Absolutely. I'm going to say something which may be seen controversial to some. I think there's too much middle management, too much micromanaging of staff. I think there's so many people in suits that I don't know what they do.
Uh-huh.
But I know they cost the taxpayer a lot of money, and there should be more people on the front lines who actually provide the service. That's what I would sort of argue and get more people so things run smoother. And you got to pay people appropriately. That's why all these strikes are happening, because people are feeling they're not getting the appropriate money for the work they do. I know in Scotland, last time I checked with the BMA in Scotland and the government up here, they've come to some sort of agreement. Mm-hmm. Last time I checked, I don't know if it's true, but I know down in England, they're still sort of worlds apart.
Yeah.
So those are things I would argue. Less suits and more people in scrubs doing the work. That's what I would sort of argue for. Make it more attractive so people are willing to work the Sunday nights and stuff like that. Because if you're a freelancer, let's say you're not tied to any sort of hospital and you're freelance. If you're gonna work a Sunday night, you need to make it attractive, or Saturday night or Friday night. Yeah. Everyone's out partying, gonna enjoy themselves. Make it enticing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm going to be in Wetherspoons or wherever I'm going to be at enjoying myself, man. You know what I mean? Night shifts I've done where my friends have been in a WhatsApp group. The WhatsApp group is popping off. Everyone's enjoying it. Oh, I'm here. And then you're going to do a PR exam. And how tough that is. You're looking at this arsehole. I need to examine this arse while my friends are down having a whale of a time. Oh, it's tough, man. It's tough. So make it enticing.
That can be some people's idea of a good time, depending on what kind of arse.
That's just something we want to end the night, man. I'm starting my night with an arsehole. That's too forward.
Listen up, bozos. Hope you're enjoying the ep so far, but guess what? I've got a big announcement for you. One, this man next to me, Stuart McPherson, he's got a couple of plugs to do for stand-up comedy. What are they?
I feel so under pressure. Is this how your dad used to sell fireplaces? I'm doing.
Are you cold?
Listen up, cunt.
I'm doing the stands in Glasgow, Tuesday the 19th of March. Love That For Me, it's called. It's my last friend's show. Please come to that. I believe there's still tickets. I've not been checking, but I believe there is. I'm also doing two work in progress shows at Van Winkle West End, two consecutive Saturdays, also for the Glasgow Comedy Festival. I think the 16th and 23rd. Looking forward to
that. In the diary.
New jokes. I'll see you there.
That's all. Jennings, quick.
I am filming my last year's Fringe show back in Edinburgh on the 13th of February. We're doing a 7 and a 9 o'clock show at Monkey Barrel Comedy. If you didn't see the show at the Fringe last year, or you did and you just want to see it while it's getting filmed, there's still tickets available for both of the shows there. Do come along.
Great room, great comic, there. Great show.
And
great.
I've also got, I'm just putting up a new show and I've got another work in progress date on sale. The Glasgow Comedy Festival ones in March are sold out, but we've just added another date at the Stan Comedy Club in Glasgow on the Sunday 19th of May.
That's three or four.
So do snap them up quickly. I will also have a date in Dundee. I should have on sale by the time this goes out too. That's around about the, I think it's the 17th of May actually, Friday night. So
there you go.
If you want to see me, there's where I'll be.
Yes. I had Stevie? A live show, but sold out. Unlucky. But I've got a short film coming out soon. Look out for it. I'm not allowed to tell you anything about it yet, but look out for it. May or June.
I want to speak to you about that on the Patreon.
Sure. Yes. Look out for that. Well, save that, guys.
Yes. I'm going on tour. It's not announced yet, but, prick your ears up. We'll be online. I'll be shouting about it.
Keep your eyes peeled for Stu's tour. Hopefully see you at the stand-up shows. And enjoy the rest of the episode.
Enjoy.
You're a dad, that was your next
show? Man. Yeah. I'm a father. My boy was born October 2022. And being a father is exciting, man.
Yeah.
Gives you, like, it's not to say, because I hate people that, like, oh, my child gives me purpose. And whilst that is true, it doesn't mean that those without children don't have purpose. But I definitely feel more of a, like, before comedy was just that, son comes in, aside from it. Now it's like, nah, like if a promoter fucks up my money, you're not fucking up my money, you're fucking up his money.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of impetus, like, don't mess around because you're messing up his pampers, you're messing up his milk, you're messing up the stuff I want to do for him. So it's definitely like, okay, now it's not just ha-ha money, it's literally like, no, this is serious.
Real stakes.
Real stakes at hand, man. These jokes pay the bills now and they're going to make sure he's good as well. So it's definitely giving me more of a, like, all right, man, this is, if you want to make this your career, go hard, go crazy with it.
Yeah.
So see, in terms of that, like because obviously you mentioned about COVID and stuff. Yeah. So were you kind of planning on doing your debut hour in 2020? Or was it just by the time things got back, you were then ready to do it, sort of thing? Because you done that, when was it you done your No Scrubs show?
No Scrubs was 2022. So my initial plan, so if COVID didn't happen, my plan, I was going to audition for the reserve in 2020. So I was invited for an audition.
For people listening, it's Pleasance Reserve.
Pleasance Reserve, correct, yeah. So I was going to audition. Obviously, no, I wouldn't have known if I would have got it, but I was going to audition. My plan, hopefully, in 2020 was to go up with a reserve or do a mixed bill sort of thing.
So you're doing this like three or four people, they do a kind of split bill, and then it's like the idea is maybe then you go back and you'll do your debut with somewhere like the Pleasance or whatever.
Exactly. And the attraction is, if you do the reserve, is that they pay for your accommodation, which obviously we know for Edinburgh, people that obviously aren't based in the city is a ball ache. And they just basically do a show, you just turn up, do a show, which is actually kind of nice. Yeah. So my hope would have been to be competitive enough to get on that, do that in 2020, and then come back in 2021 with the debut. So COVID just pushed, just delayed, meant I didn't go up to the reserve and just pushed the debut back to 2022, a year later. So yeah. I was determined, after the restrictions started slowing down in 2021, I was like, look, man, I'm sitting on this material. Because obviously with all of us, I presume with our debut hours, we were like, we've got all this material that we've been working in the club as we build up the 10s, the 20s and stuff like that, that you think is good enough because you're like making people laugh every weekend with it. And you're like, you know what? If Edinburgh is where you announce yourself properly as a comedian, let's go, let's do it.
Yeah.
That was my attitude. Let's go, man. Let's take it. So I enjoyed that challenge,
man. How did you find your first Edinburgh show? Did you like it?
I enjoyed it. Some critics didn't, but I enjoyed it. No, I enjoyed the, you know, I enjoyed the fact that my whole modus of operandi was to just get up and perform a show.
Yeah,
that is the closest, even though I've been going full time, that's the closest I felt to a proper comedian. That like literally all I gotta do is just do a show for an hour. That's it. Yeah. That's all I gotta do. Bliss.
Yeah.
Bliss. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the challenge of creating it, taking it to different festivals and working on it and, you know, putting a body of work together. Cause when you do a 10-minute spot, it's kind of like you just go on stage, you gotta be bam, 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 bam. Or even 20 sometimes, you got a bit more leeway over 20, but if you're in a club, you want to impress, you wanna be da-da-da-da. So when you got an hour, whilst you can be bam, 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 you can just take your time with it, really get into a narrative, really make points and stuff like that. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. And it's definitely looking back to the boy who was on stage who only lasted 3.5 minutes. Like, I went from that to a whole hour. So even on a personal level, it's like, look how much growth that is.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And it's validation that, you know, these sort of dreams you kind of have, it's just, if you just work it can happen. You know what I mean? Like, going from 3.5 minutes to people coming to you, putting their own money and time to come see you, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I can do, like, I'm doing Glee this weekend. I can go to a Glee. There are people coming to Glee. They may see me and like me, but they're coming because of Glee. When you're doing your own show in Edinburgh, it's like, no, that's your name at the top of the door. What?
It's, even if you're doing touring or not as well, it's like you're then the night's entertainment. You 100%. Are the show as opposed to being part of a show.
100%.
And that's a big difference. But
very humbling.
It's also because sometimes in the comedy clubs and all that, and you know, it's like with like the certain clubs that will, you know, you need to jump through a lot of hoops or something, and they won't, you know, they'll have you in the open spot longer than you feel you should be.
Absolutely.
You'll maybe not, oh no, you can't headline or something like that. But then suddenly when you're doing your own show, and like you say, it's like that's the time you feel, no, I'm a proper comedian. I just gave these people a whole show. Everyone loved it. It went
well. Absolutely.
And it just gives you that confidence, doesn't it?
100%.
Yeah.
Rather than just being at the mercy of, like, you know, the whims of whatever promoter.
A booker. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you feel like you're the man. You feel like you're the man. Because I booked a little tour for myself post-Edinburgh, which I did early 2023. And just going to venues and, like, because I booked myself to go to venues, I want to put the show on and stuff. And then places that I've not really frequented are selling out. You're thinking, what the fudge? No. What you like? I'll just say Cambridge. Like, I went to the Junction. I've performed in Cambridge maybe two or three times, and I sold 100 seater out. And I'm like, what? Why is 100 people coming to see me?
Yeah,
it's just humbling. And then they enjoy it. And people after the show, they want to talk to you and like stuff you brought in the show. They relate to and stuff. And it's just like, what? Like, that's crazy. That was definitely
a lot of junior doctors there.
Oh, yeah, quite a few healthcare stuff. You get quite a few doctors, get quite a few sort of nurse stuff and other allied healthcare professionals. But then you also got like teachers, people who also work in public service, that if you're talking about cuts or difficulties, they're like, look, man, we have the same in the classroom, da 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 da. And then there's that sort of chat. And then you get people who are just interested in health.
Right.
Or people who couldn't afford Adam K. So, you know, you get a trickle down, man. So, yeah, I'll take that, man. I'll just make sure my tickets are cheaper than his. I get a trickle down effect, man.
Do you think, could you write a book with the experience you've had? Have you got any crazy stories and stuff?
To be honest, I've read his book, but it was a few years ago, and I didn't watch the series. I was wary of not crossing. It's a whole material thing. Sometimes you watch something, and then it goes into subconscious, and then a few years later, oh, that's a brilliant joke. Where did that come from? And then, so it's more, especially when I was writing the show, I didn't want any crossover. So maybe I'll go watch it in the future, but I definitely didn't watch it at the time. But I don't know if I'll have enough to do a whole series.
No.
There's stories, there's crazy stuff that's happened, but I don't know if I could elongate it. Because he was a doctor longer than I was. He was a registrar for a few years, so he definitely had a longer period to sort of lean into, which I don't.
Yeah.
So maybe not. But you know, someone gave me a good book deal, man. Hey, I can find something. Hey, man, I'll be fabricating. Don't worry, man. I'll make something up if the O's are correct. Hey.
You must have got, because obviously by the time you've done your show in 2022, obviously, you've worked through that whole pandemic. There must have been a lot of stuff came out of that in terms of working in the NHS then.
There was a bit. I didn't delve into it too much, to be fair, because the director I had, shout out Det Munro, he was like, when we were writing the show, he was wary of material being oversaturated by that point. And so I didn't lean into it too much. It's funny enough, this new show I've written, there's little jibes about the pandemic, but I didn't want it to be a show that had a short shelf life. So there's stuff I could have talked about, but it's just more, I was like, how long would this last? Right.
Yeah.
What was that experience? And I would be curious about that, like just in terms of COVID and stuff.
Hey, man, headless chicken, man. No one knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Oh, aye?
No one knew what was going on. People were going to me, oh, you're in the healthcare field, you must know what's going on. I'm like, I'm finding out on BBC News like you. I'm watching BBC News like you. I don't know what's going on. I want BBC to find out what I should expect in hospital. They were sending us bulletins, but everyone, like how the government were acting, obviously followed through to how the hospitals were. No one, we were doing these things. I remember we came in one time, they were charging us, like the doctors and nurses and stuff, to like put down, help build the one-way system in the hospital. So we're giving tape to put arrows on the floor and stuff like that.
Foxy, that shouldn't be your job. Fucking hell.
Foxy.
Headless chicken. No one knew what then. They gave us lessons on how I had to teach some of my colleagues. I was part of, as well as being part of the surgical team then, I was also part of the education team for that year. So they were like, oh, okay, you can help teach people stuff. And I had to give a lesson on teaching PPE. People come to lessons and say, well, we ain't got no PPE on our ward. It's not been delivered yet. And obviously, this is the time where Matt Hancock's trying to do deals with Turkey, and the plane from Turkey, the PPE was no good. All this other rubbish.
Yeah. He's examining his own asses as well.
Hey! Hey, Matty Hancock, you know. Crazy guy. Crazy guy. Talking about care homes, he had booty in his office, man. What a crazy motherfucker, man. But anyway, crazy guy. Crazy, crazy. I can't believe I was trying to follow his lead. I can't believe it. But it was just the headlessness and the loss, the pandemonium that was happening at governmental level definitely filtered through to the hospital. No one knew. Like, I'm trying to teach you about PPE. PPE's not even here. The whole dinner lady stuff was true. In like little white flimsy aprons and putting on little caps. There was nothing. There was nothing. No one knew what was happening. It was rapidly changing. The hospitals weren't sort of ready. There was a lack of pandemic preparedness. So it was literally pandemonium until people sort of got foothold of what was going on. The initial months, like March and April and May. Whoa. Complete mess, man.
But that's a unique experience that you've had getting through it and stuff, and it's like obviously you had the whole thing, people clapping for you in the street and all
that.
Hey
man, I enjoyed that. Hey man, sometimes I'll just leave the house at first. I had nowhere to go, man. I just wanted to feel good about myself. I needed an ego boost, man. You don't need no sertraline. Just go get some claps on a Thursday, man.
Was it similar to the claps you're getting as a comedian on stage?
I've written bits about this, man. Pre 2020, I didn't really talk too much about being a doctor. So I didn't really mention it. Let me tell you, when I saw the love all getting during the pandemic, I'll come out in a full hazmat suit, man. I did them. I took all the love, man. Bane mask, the whole shebang, man. Like, we were getting crazy, crazy love. And yeah, definitely now mentioning it. It's weird. Could have been a few years on. Mm. Definitely like 2021, 2022. You say you're a doctor. Hey, man.
Yeah.
Now everyone's like, all right, man. All right, man. We've clapped for you enough, man. Like, yeah, man. We're past all that, man. Now it's been like, all right, man. Tell the jokes, Michael.
Yeah.
Get on with the jokes.
That just pisses me off so much, though, like when you're saying about like strikes and stuff like that and how, you know, they're not willing to meet the demands of the doctors. And you're like, there was so much lip service paid to our NHS and fucking Love Hearts and all that stuff at the time, and then it's like, yeah, a few years later, they will not, like, not even giving you what they're asking for, and it's just back to like, no, we actually don't give a fuck still.
I was so worried when the government sat back in that, because I knew this was going to happen. I knew. When I saw Boris on number 10 clapping, we're in trouble. Because when they're back in this initiative, they're going to be like, we love you. You guys got to keep going, man. You're doing your thing. Da-da-da-da-da. We saved Boris Johnson's life. He was on the life support machine and they saved his life. Da-da-da-da. I said, we're in trouble. Because when it comes to actual paying money, showing true gratitude, because let's be real, man. We live in a capitalist society. If you appreciate someone, you pay them more.
Yeah.
That's it. You think I could book Drake for my birthday and clap? You think Drizzy Drake's gonna come and I'm just gonna applaud him? Fuck no, man. You pay someone what you think they deserve, man.
Yeah.
That's so true. Like, I remember I used to work in a call center, right? And they used to always do these things like where they would go, oh, and so at the end of the month, you know, we'll give like whoever's got the best sales or something. And it was always like these love to shop vouchers some wee thing, or sometimes if the phones are really crazy and like they were asking people to do overtime and that, it would always be like they would just bring in like a pizza or something. Mm. You're like, no, just fucking pay us more.
100%.
Like, oh, we really value you. All right, well, fucking, you know, 100%. Put your money where your mouth is, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
100%. So all of this is just, it's just lip service to me. All of this clapping, like, man, the public can clap. Do your thing. Mm-hmm. Support. That's how you got to support us. You pay your taxes. You contribute to the NHS. Do your thing. But when it's the people that are the paymasters, the ones that can decide, and they're always like, oh, no, there's a review body that decides what we should pay. The same review body that will be giving you guys double-digit increases. You don't mind that.
Yeah.
You don't mind that. But when it comes to other people, oh, well, we've got to respect the review body. It's like, oh, come on, man. Bunch of wankers, man. It's because more time, they don't use it. Most of them, I know Boris Johnson's during the pandemic, but most of them probably have private healthcare.
Yes.
They probably don't even rely on their health service. So it crumbling or it not function that well, it doesn't bother them too much because they don't really use it.
I had a bit in my last special about this, right, where I was talking about like that exact thing. Yeah. Like, they don't use it, so they like they don't care about it being fucked because they don't rely on it the way that we do. And it was reminding me because one time, right, I was in the Pure Gym, right, and there was this bald guy, right, no shade, right,
but
there was this bald guy, and he was in the Pure Gym changing rooms, and he was using the communal hairdryer in the changing rooms. And he was rubbing it directly against his like wet socks.
What the fuck?
I'm standing there looking at him like, I need to fucking use that after him. And he doesn't care because he doesn't need to use it for what it's been used for. And I'm like, go and fucking, just because you don't use it doesn't mean you ruin it for everybody else. You know what I mean? Fucking unbelievable. Oh,
great analogy. I love it. Hey, some bold guy, they're selfish, man.
I used to say, aye, that was a fucking, what'd you call him? The cunt that used to be the health secretary.
Yeah.
What was his name? Patel or whatever. The cunt that his dad was a bus driver. What was his name?
Savage Javid.
He looked up and it was him, and then we've had another like three fucking health ministers since.
You better burn through them jokes, man. But yeah, you can't even write a health secretary joke now. There's no point. They'll change before you can get to land.
It's changed so much. Bye. So your new show then is about being a dad.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I'm gonna tour it end of the year in the autumn. I'm gonna come up. I'm gonna make sure I show face in Scotland. Hopefully Glasgow and Edinburgh.
Yes.
And, I don't know about Dundee and Aberdeen yet, man. But we'll get there in the future, man. Do you guys, when you told you go up there?
Sometimes.
Well, I think see that you're saying about Cambridge, because I always feel like, oh, I've never got, because who's going to come and see me there?
Yeah.
But I feel like was more likely somebody would come and see me in Aberdeen or Dundee than like somewhere like South England. Like but I guess you never know till you do it. But
100%. Yeah. I definitely want to hit, obviously, the two bigger cities of Edinburgh and Glasgow in the next tour. So it's the working title, which I think I'm going to stick with, is Trust Me, I'm a Daddy. So it's a play on Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, but I'm putting the daddy in there.
That's what you thought Sam Lake's show was called, Dillowy.
Right. What was it called? Call Me Daddy?
No, that's just what you thought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Steve was like, so Sam, your show's called Call Me Daddy? He's like, no, I was like...
That's just what I see when I see the poster.
That's the show I'm working on. Yeah, it's about fatherhood. It's about taking the plunge of comedy whilst, you know, the challenges of being a father. It's talking about comparing how I'm going to raise my son to how I was raised, looking at how I was fathered, so to speak.
Right.
But also looking at the challenges of sort of stepping away from medicine and the timing of doing that. So those are the sort of themes I'm rolling with. And yeah, I've done a few previews. I'm real, even though it's only, we're early in the year, I'm real excited. So by the time it's autumn, it's going to be cooking, man.
What would be an example of how you were raised and the way you would change it to how you're going to raise your, as a son?
Yeah, my boy Nathaniel. It's just more like expectation. So, for example, my parents' generation were very much, you know, like, doctor. Be a doctor, be a lawyer, be a... engineers.
I think you said in the special that was like your mum's
put
on you.
The prophetess, apparently. Yeah. I'm not sure if I believe all of this, but the prophetess who, when I was born, said this guy's gonna be a doctor. You know what I mean?
A prophetess? A female prophet,
man. She knew this boy was gonna be a doctor, and you know, apparently it came true. So they gave her praise and glory. Not my 5 years of studying. They gave her the praise and glory when I graduated.
Wait, where did your mum meet this prophetess? Because my mum used to have a pal that was a psychic. She'd meet in the bus sometimes.
I don't know how innocuous it is. I don't know if it was the bus or the church. I'm not sure. So that was my parent generation, very much like traditional sort of well-paid community jobs. Where I'm a bit more loose, man. I'm a bit more like, if you believe in yourself and you know and you're determined, you want to make it happen, go for it, man. You know what I mean? There's different, but also I don't really talk about this in the show, but also I think it's a subtext of obviously when my dad came to England from Nigeria, so there's definitely a mentality like, if I'm going to make this sacrifice, you better not fuck around.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas the fact that I'm even saying I want to do comedy is just demonstrate how far we've come.
Yeah.
And that I could be like, well, I want to do this creative field and see what happens. So then I guess that attitude I've got is very much what I'm going to pass my son. Like, if you believe in it, in yourself, and you think you're good at it, do it. It's not going to be so prescribed where it's like, no, you better be a doctor or you fucked up. You know what I mean? Yeah. So just, I'm a bit more chilled.
You're just don't be a comedian because I don't need the competition.
I don't need the competition. Yeah, you see the father-son stuff. Hey, that's tight, man. That's tight. I don't want to be Chet Hanked by my son or whatever. What a guan, man.
That's great. We've almost done an hour, so almost wrapping up. We used to do a thing on this where we would do like a sort of
philosophical
sort of thing. I actually came across a thought experiment or a thought thing that we could maybe
do.
Sure.
So there's two kind of versions of it. I'll do this version because you come from a medical background, right? So this is a thought, and you could just...
If someone's released from care and then they die the next day, whose fault is it?
Blame the ambulance. Blame the ambulance. They did something wrong with the stretcher.
So this is obviously theoretical, so you just need to use your imagination. But
okay.
So there's triplets is the triplet thing. You might have heard it. Triplets in a car crash.
Oh, wow.
Two of them.
It's not all laugh.
One of them, their body is fucked, but their brain works. And two of them, their brains are work, but they're... No. What did I say?
The brain must be fucked in the other two, then.
Yeah.
Have you been in a car crash?
One brain works, the body's fucked. Two, the opposite, essentially. Yeah. So they take the working brain, split it in two, and put it into the two triplets, and it works. It's a success. But those two triplets believe that they are that original person with that brain.
Okay.
So who is dead and who is alive? And who's who?
This is interesting that you've picked up on this as a triplets thing, because I've done this in, when I had done philosophy at uni, and it was the, but this dates it as well, because the example was if you swapped Bush's brain with Bin Laden's brain.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why they've made it free. That just seems to complicate. Why do you need half a brain? That's mental.
Because there's two, I guess it's like they both think that they're that person. You know, two of them think that they're that one person.
Yeah, so yeah.
You know, I guess you could just do...
All right, like, okay, who's right? So, but yeah.
So both of them think that they are triplet A.
But neither of them are right, really.
Well, that's the whole thing. So do you think... Is your body, I guess, who you are, or your brain? Do you know what I mean? Your subconscious.
I say your.
I like how we've got a surgeon on here.
I think it's more your brain sort of dictates who you are more than your body. That's what I would argue. Because you could make a judgment call on someone based on how they dress or their body type or their physique, but if their brain could be completely sort of different. You may see, let's just say, a young lady who, you know, has got a very short skirt and, you know, certain sort of cleavage. You may think, oh, they're promiscuous, but they could be completely not, and they're a Harvard professor, for example. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So what's going up?
Wait, where is this woman, by the way? She's gonna live my dream.
I'm sorry I brought her to life, Mark. I'm sorry. That was meant to be just your wet dream for you, man. But I just exposed her for you. But so I think sometimes you can make judgment calls, but you don't really know until you get to sit down with someone and speak to them and get an idea of who they are. I think your brain is definitely more powerful than any sort of, and also your body decays after a while, man, and you still keep this before dementia comes anyway.
But. Well, that's what I think often when I look at old people, and I think they're a young person in their brain still, and it's 100%. Like, yeah, you've got this body that looks older than thing, but in it, and that's sometimes you judge audience members, you go, oh no, there's a bunch of grey hair out there,
100%.
It's going to be shit, and then you go out and they love it, and
of
like,
course.
There's wee old guys like going, ah, it's brilliant, and all that, you know, I fucking did that shagging back the day, and all that, so, like, you know,
because it makes them feel youthful, especially if we're younger, much younger than them, we're going on stage and we're talking about stuff we're getting up to, so it's probably they're reminiscing their youth through us,
yeah,
and you know, as you say, we can make a judgment call, because sometimes you get promoters, oh, don't be too blue of these older lads. Let us decide how we want to play the game, man. That's the challenge of being a comic, that you go on stage and you got to figure it out. But yeah, I think sometimes we can make assumptions about older lot.
But then do you think they say that you get more conservative the older you get? That's a thing, isn't it?
So I've heard that logic.
Do you change a bit the older you get? I guess.
Yeah, I guess you value different things. I guess if you're, you know, we got the whole youth older divide. We saw it with Brexit. We saw it with now the cost of living crisis. You know, you got young people who are skinned, can't afford to get on the housing ladder. They're like, "What? Are my futures doomed?" And you got the older lot who probably they've paid off their house. They're in a big fuck off house. They probably got spare rooms they don't really need.
Yeah.
They're sort of doing all right for themselves. So that when they're like, "What cost of living crisis?
Yeah,
what one?" And then the young people are like, "I can't even afford to pay my rent or whatever it is." So you're going to always see things from different perspectives depending on your sort of financial sort of circumstance, aren't you?
You probably just get more, you get more selfish the more stuff you have, and then you get what you protect and all that stuff. I think that's where that sort of thing comes from.
Also, I think you do get a bit more squeamish. Like, you've got a bit where in your show about eating ass, and it's like the kids are all eating ass, but you don't want it's not your thing. And maybe is that because you're older? Maybe when you were 18,
damn, the woman that we're dreaming of lacks her ass eating. So, you know, Mark, you need to change your flow, man.
I need to inspect some asses.
Get with it, man. Stop being frigid, man. Get with it, man.
No, to be fair, actually, since I've done that bit, my opinion has changed on
Exclusive.
Hey, keep this for the
Patreon. Yeah, my mind's been altered on that. So sometimes you get a bit more liberal as you get older. You know?
I thought your breath was stinking today.
Hey, that fecal breath, man.
No, come on. Just when we thought we were out of the horrible medical chat,
we came circling right back. Halitosis.
Are you nasty these days, then?
I think that the I don't think that the twins are the wee boy, no.
back to that. I don't know why it's I guess the triplet thing is because it's they look the same. If you put the brain into the body, then they wouldn't, if they looked in a mirror, they might not know that they're different, I suppose. Mm.
Can you still use their young Scott card or whatever?
you get away with their ID.
With
their real card. But then your thing with the Bin Laden in the bush thing, obviously, is different.
So I it's like, you know, who's Bush and who's Bin Laden? Is Bin Laden in the White House now? Or,
oh, the thought of that, that is crazy, man. Jeez, is he pushing all the wrong buttons? What's he doing, man?
No, that was funny. That was the example back in the day. Just shows you how fucking long ago it was. That
scary times. I'd never, I remember seeing the Twin Towers happening. I was thinking, fuck, like, because I live in London, I was looking at Canary Wharf. Could that be next? Like,
I was looking at a bunch of high flats in Clydebank thinking that they were next. I was just waiting for him. I didn't really know the geopolitical landscape at that point. Do you know
what I mean? you were so comfortable, man. You didn't even know how safe you were.
No, I did not. No. Whereabouts in London did you grow up?
I grew up in South London, famous South London, initially Bermondsey. So Guy's Hospital is a hospital just in Southwark. So brought up there till I was eight. And then when I was eight, my parents moved further out to Woolwich. And then lived there until I went uni. And then now I live in North London. So I bought a place with my wife in North London. So yeah, so I've migrated.
So you're like, what cost of living crisis?
Hey, man, I don't know too much about it. I don't know too much, but oh no, my mortgage is up for, is going to run out soon, man. That fixed rate is going to, hey, man.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, man, they're going to have their way with me. Martin Lewis can't save me. No. I mean,
at least you've always got the medical shit to go back
to. If these gigs don't pay, man, you'll see me in the scrubs. Stethoscope on as well, man. But that's just London. But that's the thing, like, that is all I know, London. Aye. So I didn't want to, when we were going to buy somewhere, I didn't want to move too far from what I know, support network and stuff like that. Because obviously I was born in London, so I know, and you have to pay a premium to live in the capital. I get that and stuff. But if it's where your community is, your network and stuff, you don't want to move too far. Because even though you're paying more, if you move somewhere else where you haven't got a network, whilst you're building that network, you may have to pay, i.e. we want a babysitter. Fortunately, we've got family members who could just come and look after the little one. Whereas if I was somewhere, let's just say Milton Keynes, where I don't have a network, then no one's going to come for free. I've got to pay out and stuff.
And also you need to live in Milton Keynes, which is not fun.
Which is the most appealing. I've not got a tour show there, so I can slate it. Shoot it to the ground.
Yes. But anyway, I think that's probably about it. Yeah, wraps us up.
That's more than an hour, so that's amazing. Thank you so much
thanks for having me, man. Just I enjoyed that, man. Shooting the breeze, man.
Yeah, that was great. Do you want to plug stuff? So I would highly recommend the special on YouTube.
Check
no
it
scrubs.
On YouTube. Yes. We'll put the link in the description.
Yeah, man. Free. It's free, man. It's free. No charge, man. Let's go watch it. No scrubs, Michael Akadiri on my YouTube page. Just an hour.
Steve's going to finish it.
He's going to finish it and come back and review it next week
for
you guys.
I'm going to watch the last 7 minutes.
The essential ending. Cliffhanger. He's on the cliffhanger right now. And then, I'm going to be touring the UK with a brand new show. Trust me, I'm a daddy. It'll be in the autumn. I'm definitely coming up to Glasgow and Edinburgh. I need to show love to the people in Scotland. So, come and see me. If you're interested,
we'll get all the dates and stuff in the link.
Absolutely,
in the description for the show notes.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for doing this, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah. As ever, guys, before we go, please do remember to like and subscribe on YouTube. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can follow us at SomeLapPod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. And send any question you've got to the email address, which Steve is what?
It's somelaughpod@gmail.com.
That's correct. Mind and sign up to the Patreon as well, guys. I've got some tickets still probably on sale for Edinburgh on the 13th of February, recording my last year's Fringe show. And also remember to get tickets to the Pavilion on the 31st of March if you haven't already.
Yes.
But aside from that, guys, thanks a lot for tuning in, and I'll speak to you very soon.
Thank you. Cheers, man. That was great.
Thank you. Peace.